Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. The first item on the agenda is a wetland presentation by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dave Wirens with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And this afternoon, I'm here to provide you with some information on the Wetland Conservation Act assessment that Bowser has undertaken on behalf of the Clean Water Cabinet over the past roughly year. Distributed by the pages should have been a copy of a PowerPoint presentation as well as a map. Yes, that's it exactly. Thank you. And what I'd like to do without further ado is kind of jump right into it and provide you some information on what we've been doing, why we've been doing it, and kind of where we anticipate our efforts going as we have moved forward during the course of this session. First off, I always like to start off with talking about the regulatory policy. I think we have to always start there when we talk about the Wetland Conservation Act. What you see on slide number two is the beginning of the regulatory policy that really provides a foundation for the Wetland Conservation Act and for the regulations that apply to wetland impacts around the state. And if you flip over to page three, you know, these 4 points really, again, they serve as the foundation for the Wetland Conservation Act. All the regulations that apply to wetland impacts, how they're regulated, is within the confines of these 4 points. Obviously, the ones that generate the most attention, one and two, where, again, achieve no net loss is the fundamental goal that WACA strives to meet. And we'll discuss some of the practical realities of that once you get into some discussion of the assessment and what we're trying to do with that. But I think you also need to take a look at what goes on in number two, where it says we should be increasing the quantity and quality. Number three directs to avoid direct or indirect impacts. And where avoidance is not feasible or practical, then to move on to wetland replacement. Moving on to page four of the presentation, kind of where this whole work activity started was every 2 or 3 years at Bowser, we develop a Minnesota wetland report. The purpose of the report is to gather data from all state and federal programs, regulatory and non-regulatory, that have an impact on wetlands within the state of Minnesota. And as part of that, we collect data from all the federal and state agencies that have a bearing on wetland change in the state. The report does not make policy recommendations. The purpose of the point is to collect the data and to provide information which to make future policy decisions. Therein lies why we are here today. But and then obviously it's used to identify trends and program accomplishments, to identify what is happening within the state of wetlands in Minnesota. You move on to page five, the one chart of data that I will share with you today, and I believe this is the chart that really moved the governor to direct the Clean Water Cabinet to undertake this assessment, is the data we show in this table. And this really captures the activity under the Wetland Conservation Act from what's reported to Bowser from local units of government. As we look at this, I think the key points of data are, if you look at that third row, this is the impact acres, and you'll notice that we roughly average about 300 to 330 acres per year of regulated impacts. And then the replacement acres, the Wetland Conservation Act, as I just noted, requires replacement where impacts cannot be avoided. These are the acres that local governments have required applicants replacement wetland acres that local governments have required applicants to develop to compensate for their impacts. And you notice that in every year of this report, there is a net gain when you look at regulated impacts and compare that with the required replacement. However, there also are a group of 10 categories of exempt activities that are fundamentally unregulated under the Wetland Conservation Act. And in that role, you notice that we're averaging about 550 acres on roughly an annual base of impacts. And then once you use a very simple math and add up the impacts plus the exempt and subtract out the replacement, you will notice that Wetland Conservation Act, in fact, does result in a net loss. And again, this is the data reported to us by local government. And I think this also represents the way the Wetland Conservation Act is, in fact, structured. This is a law working as drafted, as intended. And I think we need to be clear on that.
Mr. Wirens,
yes.
How is a replacement wetland acre defined?
A replacement wetland acre, it is defined as part of the replacement plan process that runs through local governments, and it's going to vary depending upon the impact and the location of the impact. One thing to take a look at that map, you notice there are three zones on there. One is greater than 8% of pre-zoned wetlands, one is 50 to 80, and another one is less than 50. If you're in a less than 80% part of the state, you have to do 2 acres of replacement for every acre of impact. So you're getting more than 1-to-1. But then there also are requirements to match wetland type as well. That if you're impacting a type 3 wetland, the local government should be directing the applicant to work towards a type 3 replacement wetland as well. The goal is to have replacement wetlands look as much like a natural wetland as possible as part of the process, and that does take time as well, usually 3 to 5 years of monitoring time to ensure that replacement wetland looks like and acts like a natural wetland.
But what are the other types of situations where a replacement wetland acre may not look like that traditional working, looking, smelling wetland?
Mr. Chair, the program is structured in a way to create incentives to replace what was impacted of the same type in the same location. So that if you do impact, say, a type 3 wetland and choose to replace it with a type 5 wetland, there'd be a penalty incurred, and you have to replace more wetland type to compensate for the fact that's not like for like. So in terms of that, that's kind of one way. I suspect part of your question is in terms of wetland quality. If you might have the appropriate amount of acreage, if you don't have the right kind of quality, am I correct in reading that part of your question? Of the quality nature. That is part of the process that we do require local governments to do monitoring of wetlands and to require corrective action if it's warranted based upon an examination of that wetland and if, in fact, it is meeting the requirements of the replacement plan.
So back to the example of a few hearings ago with the Walmart and the concrete pond with the kind of the boat ramp going into it, that was supposedly a replacement acre. Was that a violation, or was there something in the law that allowed that?
I am not specifically familiar with the circumstance you're referring to, but there is allowance within the statute and rules that stormwater ponds under certain circumstances can receive replacement credit under the Wetland Conservation Act.
So the definition of wetland can, in at least certain circumstances, include a stormwater pond.
Mr. Chair, what it gets back to is the concept of wetland functions and values. And to the extent different actions generate wetland functions and wetland values, it can, in fact, achieve replacement credit. And stormwater ponds do provide some wetland functions and values. But I think the case also made that they rarely provide the full range of wetland functions and values. And that has been a point of some discussion and debate during the course of the assessment of stormwater management areas, stormwater ponds. What is their appropriate role in the context of replacement credit? And that is something that we have addressed within our report, too, of a way to move forward to further work on that issue.
Thank you.
To move on to slide number 6, the WAC assessment got its instruction forward in a letter from Governor Pawlenty to the Clean Water Cabinet, where the direction from the governor was to consider doing more to limit the loss of wetlands through the regulatory mechanisms of the Wetland Conservation Act, and to report on the following issues to be more closely aligned with the principle of no net loss. Again, as I just indicated, the current data we have, WAC is not resulting in a net loss of wetlands, and his directive to us is how do we more closely line, the way I always characterize it is, how do we narrow the gap that we've identified currently within the data we have? If you flip over to page 7, the scope of the assessment, there are three main areas of examination that we undertook as part of this process. To look at wetland data, to make sure that we have better data than we currently do on wetland gain, loss, change under the Wetland Conservation Act. That obviously we need to do more to limit the loss of wetlands, and that's principally done by examining the exempt activities. and by how replacement occurs, the replacement ratio is being a key part of that. And then the third piece is how do you make WACA work better, work more efficiently? As part of that, we looked at how we can streamline regulatory efforts. I don't need to tell the committee, but it is a very complex world of what the regulations out there that has involvement by a variety of federal, state, and local authorities that are interacting out there. And we are taking efforts to look at ways to make that work more efficiently. To flip over to page 8, just to briefly run through the process, as I indicated earlier, the assessment started roughly a year ago last week, where the first meeting of a large and diverse stakeholder group was formed that was led by Bowser and included the full range of agriculture, business, local government, state, federal agencies. We had over 35 different organizations that were participating in the stakeholder committee. They met 14 or 15 times from February through October. I had a wetland roundtable of the same groups in November to wrap up our work on the assessment, to identify consensus where we could, and if not, to give some direction to the wetland committee of the board. That is a subcommittee of our board that spent a great deal of time and effort looking at the various options to come up with some recommendations to meet the goals of the assessment. The Bowser Board accepted the report on December 20th, and just last week the Clean Water Cabinet did as well, accepted that and moved it along. The key considerations, moving over to page 9, again, these are the background for the whole range of recommendations that are found within the assessment. Is obviously our first goal has to be to be responsive to the directive from the governor, to be more closely aligned with the principle of no net loss, to update and simplify the statute where we can. Keep in mind that the Wetland Conservation Act is 15 years old, and while it's been amended a number of times, there are obsolete provisions based upon the passage of time, based upon the passage and change of federal laws. We need to look at administrative cost. I mean, there is a cost at the state and local level and on the basis of landowners to comply with the regulations of the Wetland Conservation Act. And obviously, you need to be aware of landowners. Wetland Conservation Act and its regulations apply to private lands and to landowners who have to comply with their regulations when they are proposing to undertake an activity that's going to impact a wetland. If we flip over to page 10, there are four areas of recommendations that were the result of this year-long effort. Again, changes to wetland reporting and accounting, changes to the exemptions, changes to wetland replacement and wetland administration. And again, trying to move this along so the committee has a chance to ask any questions that you may in fact have. I'm not going to go through each of the items that were proposed for change through the course of the assessment. But what I will do is highlight some of the more significant items, some that are more controversial, items that undoubtedly you've heard about as well in meeting with individuals during the course of this session so far. The first thing we did in looking at the group of changes is divide them really into two categories, changes that we can make via the rulemaking authority that the board has, and rule changes that require statutory change to come in effect. And we are working on legislation to bring those ideas forward as well that require statute to be put into effect. But I think first off, to talk about a few of the items that we can do via rulemaking or other administrative authority that we have at the board. The first one is in regards to WACA LG reporting, Wetland Conservation Act, local government reporting. As indicated before, the Wetland Conservation Act is administered by over 300 local units of government across the state. Counties, cities, SWCDs, watershed districts. The Board of Wild and Soil Resources does not issue a single approval for a replacement plan or for an exemption of any sort. So the data that we have on the wetland conservation and how it's performing is based upon data provided to us by local units of government. An effort that we have begun this past fall is to look at the current data we receive from local units of government to improve the completeness and the accuracy of the data that we in fact receive so that as part of future policy discussions, we're going to have better data than what we currently have on WACA. And it's our expectation that with the reporting that we will be receiving next year, roughly this time, will be based upon the new reporting standards that we are in fact developing to, again, improve completeness and accuracy and consistency of data. One other thing I'll mention is regards to forestry. There is an exemption that provides exemption from the regulations for forest roads, for access for forest management activities. And the issue gets down to the use of those forest roads. It is possible that over time those roads can change from a forest purpose to a non-forest purpose, be it recreational, be it for rural development activities. The proposal that we believe that we'll plan on doing via rule is to give direction to the local units of government that when a development activity occurs, when there's platting, when there's subdivisions, those would be triggers that would require replacement for a wetland impact that occurs under the forestry exemption. I think the other items on this page regarding replacement, I think just to mention, are some details about how replacement occurs and how we define wetland type that's in kind. We're planning on doing some changes there. And also look at issues of the timing of replacement to make sure that the wetland replacement is in hand before the impact occurs. Otherwise, there is a loss of function value until such time as that replacement, in fact, occurs. To move over to page 12, I think the one thing I would mention is under wetland administration. Again, the statute and the rule define who could be a local unit of government. There are over 300 local units of government that currently are responsible for administering the Wetland Conservation Act. It is our proposal that as part of future water planning activities, counties, watershed districts, stormwater conservation districts, all undertake water planning, that we would direct those local government to examine wetland responsibilities during the course of that planning and identify changes locally as they could to try and make sure we're maximizing the efficiency of which local governments are doing what in the context of administering the Wetland Conservation Act. Certainly, 300 local units of government is a very large number, but we also believe that having this program being administered at the local level provides for maximum effectiveness. Local people know best what's going on locally and are in best position to administer a law like this. And most often in coordination with other regulations that they're responsible for, particularly look at land use regulations. I'd like to move on now to page 13 and talk a little bit about some of the legislative changes that we are proposing as part of this assessment. With the direction given to us by the Clean Water Cabinet, we are now in a position to pursue legislation, whereas we did have to wait until that in fact occurred. I think a couple of things are worth noting here. The one thing I'll mention is in replacement siting. I draw your attention back to that map I distributed earlier where we lay out. It looks very complicated because we're showing three different geographic regions. We're showing the 81 major watersheds. We're showing the pre-summit wetland areas on there that are kind of part of the regulatory scheme of the Wetland Conservation Act. And then we're also showing bank service areas. Those are a new concept that we are proposing to institute as part of these changes to increase the flexibility in replacement siting and also to provide some greater assurance to wetland banking, which you're increasingly viewing as the preferred method to replace approved wetland impacts through the Wetland Conservation Act. We also provide some increased flexibility as part of this scheme through the for the greater than 80% area, that northeast part of the state that has a large share of its wetlands, in fact, remaining. The ag exemption and the drainage exemption need to be considered in tandem, the way the changes are coming together. This is going to look pretty significant when you see what the legislation is going to be proposing. But the purpose is to simplify it considerably, to eliminate connections to swamp buster, to eliminate connections to wetland type, but to define that an activity is exempt if it meets the definition of normal farming practices, to make it very clear and very simple. If you as a farmer are doing these things that are defined in statute, you do not need to have further consideration for the Wetland Conservation Act, because by definition, you're not impacting a wetland. But the drainage exemption, there are some changes there that are relevant. We are making some obsolete provisions be repealed. But then more importantly, we're instituting a provision that we feel is appropriate that would exempt impacts under the drainage exemption if they meet an 8 of 10-year cropping history. And the purpose of that being is that if a wetland is being farmed with normal farming practices in a significant majority of years, that is a wetland that probably has minimal public values and very minimal wetland functions and would be appropriate to allow that farmer to actually institute that as part of their normal cropping area. To move on to page 14, again, some more changes to the exemptions. I would Spend a moment just talking about the approved development exemption. This is one that we're proposing to repeal as being obsolete. The way this exemption is laid out is that if a development project received approval in the 5 years prior to 1991, it is in fact exempt. It is our belief it's appropriate to repeal this exemption, that if a development project has not been undertaken in the 15 or 20 years since, it maybe never is going to happen or is inappropriate to continue to give it an exemption of the law. The de minimis exemption is going to attract, I think, a fair amount of attention. The changes that are proposed within the WAC assessment report are to not change this exemption within that northeast zone of the state, but to reduce it by 50% within the less than 80% areas, that southern two-thirds of the state, and in fact to have a zero allowed amount within the shoreland building setback zone. And what we're referring to there is, under shoreland management regulations that local governments are required to administer, there is a zone from the ordinary high water level where building cannot in fact occur. It's our proposal to not allow any wetland impact within that zone that's unregulated. And then within the 50 to 80% area, right now 5,000 square feet is allowed as exempt. And to keep in mind that an acre is roughly 42,000 square feet. So the current exemption in that middle zone of the state is just over 10% of an acre is allowed. And in that 50% zone, the Red River Valley in the south, they have 2,000 square feet currently, which again is under 5% of an acre, and that'd be reduced down to 1,000 square feet. So again, the goals there are, we feel it's an appropriate way to again more closely align with no loss to reduce that gap. And we believe those changes, especially to the de minimis, will in fact get us there. The last couple of changes that I'll mention, flipping to page 15, is to specify that Bowser would have exempt rulemaking authority to allow us to very quickly put those rules into effect. When there are over 300 local units of government administering the Wetland Conservation Act, it really is a very high degree of need to get all those local government on the same page as quickly as possible, where we have a statute that says one thing, the rule says another. That's a recipe for a great deal of confusion out there across the countryside. You have a goal to have these rules in effect in 90 days and then promptly embark upon a permanent rulemaking authority so that within 2 years from that date, we would have permanent rules in effect that would go through the normal administrative procedures process. We flip over to page 16, the expected outcomes of all this. I think there are three primary outcomes that we anticipate the result of these changes, again, assuming they are implemented as we are currently proposing. We believe we'll have better data on which to assess the performance of the Wetland Conservation Act and which to engage in future policy discussions. We believe there will be a modest reduction in the amount of wetland loss that occurs under the Wetland Conservation Act. And we think there will be improvements in administrative efficiency and regulatory simplification. Again, to make the program work better while still protecting the wetlands that are very important to the state of Minnesota. And then the last slide I draw your attention to are the very last one, where we kind of identify the change items that are proposed for within the governor's budget. And there are four items that will improve the ability of both Bowser and local governments to administer and respond to wetland needs under the Wetland Conservation Act. The first one is $500,000 for grants to local governments to improve response to major wetland violations, $500,000 to increase Bowser's staff to provide oversight to local government, $60,000 to establish Bowser staff capacity to monitor wetland replacement banking sites, and as a one-time appropriation, $60,000 to develop the state wetland restoration strategy. I think members of the committee, it certainly is our belief that the policy changes in combination with the budgetary change items proposed by the governor, we think will have noted improvements in the Wetland Conservation Act. Certainly in light of some of the budget reductions occurring the past years, I think both state and local capacity has been reduced to respond to wetland needs, and we are hopeful to receive this funding to improve our capacity. That was a very quick overview. I'm happy to respond to any questions the committee may have.
Frederickson. Mr. Chair and Mr. Wirens, I don't have a question, but I was skimming through this as you were going through it with us on slide 3, clause 2, That did make sense to me. I think you've got a word out of place. I think after restoring, there should be the word or, and then delete the word or between enhancing or diminished.
What did
Thank you.
You
mean,
what did you mean to say in that clause?
Well, the intention is to restate the existing statute, no change. I believe what it's intended to say is to increase the quantity, quality, and biological diversity by restoring, enhancing diminished or drained wetlands. So I believe the change that Senator Fredrickson was suggesting would make that read the way it's currently in statute.
Other questions for the witness? We'll be hearing this, their Bowser's bill on Wednesday, I think. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wirens, on page 13, could you explain a little further items 2 and 3?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Dill. The proposal under the ag exemption will be the entire existing exemption that provides for a rather complex series of exempt activities that tie back to wetland type principally and back to the federal farm program, Swamp Buster. Our proposal is to simplify the application of the law so that the need to identify the wetland type, to need to identify compliance with Swamp Buster, no longer is relevant to the Wetland Conservation Act, but to establish a definition of normal farming practices that will not include draining or filling. And the purpose of that, again, is to simplify it. We are seeing increasing concerns over debating experts over wetland typing. We're having concerns over the ability to receive information from the Natural Resources Conservation Service on Swamp Buster. Making the application of the current exemption is increasing all the time with their ability to ensure that farming activities are both compliant with Swamp Buster and the Wetland Conservation Act. This proposal would have that. As a farmer, you worry about Swamp Buster over here complying with your federal obligations, and you worry about complying with the Wetland Conservation Act over here. But the other part on the drainage exemption, the way that I characterize this is that we from a farmer's perspective, we're taking away some exempt coverage under the ag exemption, but then we're giving some back under the drainage exemption by reinserting a cropping history, which we believe is a fairly easy concept to prove via aerial photography that is available in SWCD offices. That should reduce some of the complexity and difficulty of is a drainage activity exempt or not. You determine there is a cropping history and the farmer is either good to go or not, as the case might be.
Follow up.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Wirens, if I understand you correctly and if I understand this law correctly, under the current exemption, all farmers that are in the federal farm program are exempt from the 1991 Wetland Conservation Act. What you're suggesting here is that exemption will be taken away so that they'll be both under the federal Swamp Buster law plus under this 1991 Wetland Conservation Act. Is that correct?
Mr. Wirens.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, the response I would make to that is that just because a farmer is in the federal farm program covered by Swamp Buster is not necessarily a guarantee that they are exempt from the Wetland Conservation Act. And I think that's kind of one of the problems we've been experiencing both in talking to our own field staff as well as with local units of government. It's created some difficulty out there. And when you can't get data out of the NRCS, because they have some very specific limitations due to Freedom of Information Act requirements, it's very difficult to resolve disputes that occur out there. And this is part of our goal, is to simplify some of that so that we're not caught in a debate over the circumstance of a given application.
And just one more. Mr. Chair, Mr. Wirens, where's the list of people that were on this review group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I can get that for you if you want the exact individuals. We do have a list within the report where we lay out all the organizations that participated in the process. I'd be happy to get that to you after the hearing.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like that information too, if you would, please. A couple questions. What happens? Well, first of all, just kind of a general comment. I know Mr. Warens, you were probably part of it, the discussion back in the early 80s, mid-80s, over the Wetlands Conservation Act and the number of years that we put in to kind of come up with the existing regulations and the years that followed to try to get the constituents or the people who were involved in or affected by those rules accustomed to the rules and the changes from where they were before to where they were then. So I can just imagine now with a new set of rules on that you're proposing, there's going to be a whole new set of the world is happening, basically. And so I can kind of see the handwriting on the wall. But I do have some specific questions, and one of them relates to on the bottom of page 13 where you have the drainage exemption, where you move from, to a cropping history, 8 out of 10 years, the many farmers who are in this conservation reserve program that have ditch plugs that have been put in their ditches, and if their cropping history has been zero for 15 years, and they want to pull those ditch plugs out, which is according to the contract that they may or may have signed, or they would have signed, what does this mean for those people who is this 8 out of 10 last years, or 8 out of 10 years in the history of the land that it was cropped? Or, and I can see all kinds of versions of this being questioned out there.
Mr. Chair, Sarah Stuff, you should not correct is that if the proposal that we have would retain the existing CRP exemption, we do not want to create a disincentive for farmers to enter into conservation programs by creating a sort of wetland penalty. That could, in fact, be the case. So the current language of the, and we don't have the bill in front of you, so it's kind of hard to talk about all the details, but the proposal is to leave that existing language in place so that if you have I believe the current language is 6 out of 10 year cropping history prior to enrollment, then you'd be fall under the ag exemption. And we are not proposing to change that particular provision.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Warens. Yeah, if you read number 2, it says replace the current exemption with the normal farming practices, of which there is none because of the CRP contract. One other question I had is on when there was no great science to how we came up with the square feet for the existing wetlands exemption, but there was some in the sense that I think the argument was that if you had a relatively small area, and I think, 100 feet, 100 square feet, 1,000 square feet is basically, not a large area when you talk about the size of the farms that we have in some areas. And even 2,000 square feet is not very large. And then in certain years, you have a change. Now, obviously, last year was pretty nominal in terms of, it was a dry year. But I can remember many dry years and then wet years that followed, too. So I guess the question is do we want to tighten down on some of those small, they're not potholes, they're really wet in wet years, but farmed in dry years. Do we want to tighten down on those when you drive around the metropolitan area and you see huge excavations right along rivers and swamps and land development that it just used to fascinate me, and I flew for 10 years back and forth in a small plane. And once you get out of the metropolitan area, there's a lot of wetlands all the way up to northwestern Minnesota. But when you get down in the metropolitan area, the bulldozers and the scrapers are going right and left in the backhoes, and they're digging and filling, and it seems like there's absolutely no control over what happens down here. But yet that 1,000 square feet out in the middle of a 620-acre field is subject to five agencies that are going to come out and check it out.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, certainly the Wetland Conservation Act applies on a statewide basis. The difference being, of course, that there's a different kind of degree of activity in different parts of the state. That's part of what you're reflecting as well. What I would say, though, is that it's certainly talking to our staff who work within the metropolitan area and developing parts of the state, certainly the thing that we're seeing is there's a tremendous amount of regulatory activity going on where locals of government are very busy. Our staff deal with, a tremendous amount of work in reviewing replacement plans, proposed activities. The activity going on in the metro area in terms of regulatory oversight is pretty significant. And in fact, it's fairly common in the metro area for local units of government to be more restrictive than the current WACA rule within the metropolitan area in recognition of the amount of impacts and need to protect what part of the natural environment is still remaining as development keeps moving forward and forward and on. I think the other thing I would say, too, just in talking about the 8 of 10 year cropping history concept, one thing we're also trying to institute, and we're still working on how this would apply, but institute a concept of a normal precipitation year to recognize that if you're having a series of wet years, such as have been occurring in the Red River Valley for the past 10, 15 years, it's not appropriate to apply the same standards you might in other parts of the state that have not been as wet. So you want to have some recognition. Again, working on how this would apply, that we would define a normal cropping year as being within a normal precipitation year. And we're still looking how we can make that work in a reasonable fashion with the data that is available out there.
Your proposal in legislation does reduce the de minimis exemptions as well, right?
Mr. Chair, it does in all parts of the state except in that greater than 80% area.
And what geographic area would that primarily fall in?
That would be the northeast. If you look at that map, the area to the north and east of the dashed line that you see there, that is a greater than 80% zone as defined by statute.
That's all of this.
80%. And with the proposal that's within the assessment is the current 10,000 square feet that's allowed will remain 10,000 square feet in that greater 80% area. In that middle 50 to 80% zone, it'll go from 5,000 to 2,500 square feet. And in the less than 50% zone, Red River Valley in the south, it'll go from 2,000 to 1,000 square feet. The other change we would have is to protect our lakes and rivers is, again, to have a zero de minimis within that building setback zone. And that varies depending upon the classification of rivers and lakes, but it varies between 75 and 200 feet back from the ordinary high water level. There'd be no de minimis under our proposal.
The metro area falls in all three zones?
It falls in two zones, I believe, in the 50 to 80 and in the less than 50.
Okay.
I believe only Anoka County, I believe, is only in the 50 to 80 zone.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay. All right. So there would be a significant impact on the metro area with your proposal as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, the proposal that we have would increase the amount of regulated impacts than is under the current law.
The de minimis exception, because we have the ag exemption, does that de minimis exception then apply mainly to commercial development activities? Is that where the de minimis really comes into play, or is it to all activities?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the response I give is we don't have complete data on where and how the different exemptions are being applied out there. But certainly what we do see in discussing with staff is that it is the majority of individual landowner, commercial development, because they don't tend to be very large amounts. Even 10,000 square feet is not a large amount of area with the amount of wetland area that does exist in northeast Minnesota. So it's not going to allow huge activities to occur out there. But I think, you know, I would say that's probably a fair assessment. It's going to be commercial, individual landowner, those sorts of activities are where it's more likely to be used.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, I think it does get down to, what seems to be a reasonable size area. And you talk about 1,000 square feet. 1,000 sounds like a big area, but, it's relatively, it's just a hair over 30 by 30 feet, 30 feet by 30 feet. And so when you could almost have, some people have gardens that would have maybe a low area in their garden that's about that size. So it really becomes a matter of how small do you want control, state control, over someone's land. And I think that was the discussion, 20 years, some years ago, and I think it's still the discussion because you can't control the weather and whether it's a wet year or a dry year. You might be able to give some flexibility, but it all gets put back on the shoulders of who's administering it out in the field. So you get an aggressive person who sees a 1,200 square foot area, and it might not be much bigger than this, this area in between these pillars. And by darn, that person's going to make that landowner either not fill that hole in, or not drain it, or not do something with that that landowner wants to do. And that's where the conflict starts. And the unfortunate part is that the state with its agencies has a whole lot more power than that one individual who has to either go and hire an attorney or try to work through a system of a bureaucratic system that I think can be quite unreasonable. And so I just caution you that some of us who have been down that road before don't necessarily look forward to going down it again.
Well, Mr. Chair, Sarah Stump, I was, as you alluded to before, I was back involved in those discussions years ago, and I remember sitting around a table like that and having conversations, how big should the exemption be in comparison to the table we're sitting around. I know you were at those meetings as well. But I think the response I'd make is that as we are looking at this, we know that for every change we're talking about to an exemption, we're changing the workload and locus of government. And we have to be responsive to the people who make this law work out there. We can't just make a change that increases their responsibilities without having some decrease somewhere else or asking for more money to help pay for their cost of administering the Wetland Conservation Act. We've been, during the course of the assessment with the stakeholders, with the Wetland Committee Board, we spent a lot of time talking about how the fact that you can't just ratchet down the regulations because there's a cost to that. There's a cost to those sorts of changes. Nothing comes free in this. And that's why we have to be somewhat measured. We're trying to simplify, we're trying to update, which has some reduction in administrative costs, but we're also increasing costs within some other parts of the changes that are proposed here. So we're trying to be responsive to both sides of that, recognizing that we have an obligation to look at how we more closely align with known net laws. But you also have to be responsive to the local government that make WACA work. And we can't just impose on more of them without giving them more resources to get the job done.
To add to that, Senator Stump, I think there are the pressures on wetlands and in this day and age are a lot greater than when we first implemented the Conservation Act, the Wetland Act. I think it's important that we revisit these things in some way, shape, or form. We had a Wetland Summit report a few weeks ago, and we had a conversation after that as well. I thought it was a pretty good dialogue by the committee, but one thing I mentioned was that, you know, I own land too. And, you know, the government tells me how I have to operate on that land in certain ways. In fact, there's 10 feet around my land that I don't really own. And I can't build the land up exactly the way I want it. If I want to expand my garage, if I want to build up to the curb, I'm not allowed to do that. There's certain reasons for that. So I think we're all regulated by the government on our lands in some way, shape, or form for a reason. We just need to figure out if those reasons are good enough and whether the solutions are reasonable. So we'll be taking a look at the Bowser bill on Wednesday and going through the particular provisions, but I just think that we have a lot of pressure on our environment. And we're going to see a lot more as the population grows. So I think we have to consider doing something. Hopefully we'll do whatever's reasonable. Senator Bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I was a co-author of the 1991 Wetland Conservation Bill when I was in the House and was on the conference committee, and I worked with Mr. Wyrens a lot at that time. And my recollection is that the federal farm program wetland regulations, the swamp buster regulations, were substantially tougher than what we had in the 91 Wetland Conservation Act for those farmers that were not in the federal farm program. For example, we exempted all Type 1 wetlands on ag land. We exempted Type 2 wetlands up to 2 acres in size. And in the federal farm program, I don't believe those exemptions exist. Now, maybe I don't remember that right, but you can maybe help me, Mr. Wyrens. Now, Senator Stump was talking about so many square feet of wetlands out in some farm field, so forth. I'm not sure that it doesn't apply under current law, because if that farm is in the federal farm program, it's exempt and under swamp buster rules. But, Mr. Wyrens, do I remember that correctly?
Mr. Wyrens?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, I think the correct answer I can give is kind of yes and no. In that, I think if you read the current Wetland Conservation Act and the way it's connected to the Federal Farm Program and the Swamp Buster, I think the answer is yes. However, as we kind of learn more about Swamp Buster, how it's currently operating, we're no longer quite sure that, in fact, Swamp Buster operates the way today as it did 15 years ago, or at least that we thought it did 15 years ago. I'll be honest saying that before I came to Bowser, I didn't know the farm program as well as I do today, and I still have more to learn. But it certainly is what we know about the farm program today is that they use different methodologies to determine what is and is not a wetland. Their reference year for if it's a wetland or not is 1985, which is not a current WACA standard. There just are a variety of issues like that that make it increasingly difficult to reconcile the requirements of the Wetland Conservation Act and those with Swamp Buster. And again, to tag along the fact that it's very difficult to get data out of the Natural Resources Conservation Service due to requirements of federal law. So this is not a statement about federal employees, but about federal law. It makes it very difficult on the ground to work with farmers, with local governments, with conservation officers to address situations when it's very difficult to match up these various different requirements. And that's part of why it's our proposal to simplify and stop spending all that time that occurs out there of debating Swamp Buster compliance in relationship to Wetland Conservation Act compliance. Let's separate the two and make them be freestanding obligations that apply to a given farmer. It might be the same piece of ground, but certainly I think part of what you're talking about is correct, is that part of the goal of WACA in its past was not to have overlapping regulation. Well, I think as we're increasingly seeing, that's not what we're doing with this change. We're not overlapping regulation, but we're providing regulation consistent with state law and state policy.
Mr. Warren, slide five. Lower right-hand corner, 2001 to 2003, there was a net loss of 1,400 wetlands. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yeah, you're reading that table correctly in that over those 3 years, 1,367 acres, more acres of wetlands were impacted than were replaced under the Wetland Conservation Act.
And that's not even considering some of the replacement acres that might be debatable.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I would discuss that number with two cautions. The first one is you do raise issues about quality, and that is an issue of the amount of oversight and directive given to the applicant as they're developing either their project-specific replacement site or their wetland bank site. One thing I will say is that part of our request for some monitoring of money that we talked about before is to enable us to get a better handle on how well are these replacement sites performing out there. We've not had the resources to do an adequate job in that regard, and we anticipate ramping that up so we can give a better answer to the questions of how do the replacement wetlands perform out there. The other comment I make is about the exempt acres as well, and is to keep in mind that the exemptions as they currently are laid out within state law, is there's no requirement for a landowner to contact the local government. I mean, these are not permitted approvals. They apply to an activity if a landowner thinks they do, and only if they go to an LGU or if a conservation officer happens by, is there some question about it. The point being is that our data on exemptions is not complete because if they're not required to report that, we don't know how much is happening out there that's not occurring under the exemptions. But even as I say that, though, it's certainly from talking to, again, it's kind of anecdotal information, and we are planning on doing more work to get a better handle on some of this information, not in time for this session, but over the course of the summer and the fall, is that it's likely the majority of exempt activity is showing up in these numbers. But that's kind of my professional judgment, not based upon data that we currently have.
And I have to apologize. I was incorrect. The Bowser bill is not scheduled for Wednesday, so we're still waiting for it to be introduced and for it to be scheduled. So my apologies for that mistake. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wyrens, when you look on page 5 there, you've got the 1,367 acres of net loss within the regulatory system. If you expand this report to include all the wetlands that have been restored by other units of government, how many acres have been restored in that same time frame?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, we did have a table within that report, and I did bring copies if you'd like to see. It takes it into a whole new area of discussion. But certainly, the way to respond to that question, Senator Dill, and it's something that comes up quite often during the course of this discussion on wetlands, is that we tend to think of wetland change in the state as though there are two ledgers. Call one a savings account and the other a checking account. Your savings account are the conservation programs. They're the CRPs, they're the REM, they're the restorations that occur as part of wildlife management areas. But there's your checking account. That'd be the acres that come in and out of the regulatory system. As part of our task here today, as part of this assessment, our requirement was to examine the Wetland Conservation Act and how to be more closely aligned with no net loss. I think the data we have would indicate that if you look at the big picture, Minnesota likely is achieving a net gain in wetlands looking across all program activities. However, we do know under the Wetland Conservation Act that Minnesota is at a net loss under the current statutory regulatory program that's been established through this law. And that's what we're showing here, is that's what our directive was by the governor.
Follow up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wyrens, if you can't answer the question, do you know of anybody in this room that can?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, some in the room may believe they have an answer, but I would be surprised if one in fact exists on because I've had conversations with individuals. You didn't bring this up in your question, but others, of looking at natural change. What happens that has no human impact whatsoever, you know, beaver dams, whatever might be occurring out there. There is another item on your agenda is an effort to try and give us a better handle on wetland change, regardless of programs, the comprehensive wetland assessment, monitoring, mapping, and forget all the initials in that program. But that as an activity that is intended to try and give us that kind of wetland change picture, regardless of the program. The data we have is program specific. And part of our hesitancy of doing some simple math, of adding up the numbers, is that there's some duplication, there's some overlap. There are some of the restorations that occur are not permanent in nature. It's probably not appropriate to consider those the same as permanent ones. I mean, there's some of those differences that occur within the data that make it, I guess I would say, questionable to move towards giving, you know, a single number in a given year of wetland change.
I think the next item is going to explore your question a little better, Senator Dill. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wirens, I was interested in your response to Senator Dill. If you can't provide for us the full universe of all the wetlands that have been restored, would you provide for us the wetlands that have been restored under RIM and CREP?
I do have a table from the report I can hand out that has the information that as we referred to, where we tried to see a page is coming over. What we tried to do is, and if you've had a chance to examine the full report, what we did is we went through the Wetland Conservation Act in segment, and I'll just kind of give a description of what we did as it's being handed out. We went through the 01 through 03 Minnesota Wetland Report, and what we went to do is each element of the Wetland Conservation Act provided the available data on wetland banking, road replacement, enforcement appeals, on down line of different activities to just kind of show what the level of activity is. But we did a very similar kind of activity through the conservation programs. We contacted Fish and Wildlife Service and Natural Resources Conservation Service and DNR on down the line, you know, for agencies that we know have programs that have a wetland impact. And we asked them to kind of tell us over the course of these years, and these are three-year cumulative totals that were provided to us as part of this effort about a year and a half ago now, actually about 2 years ago when we started the process, to try and catalog kind of what numbers do they provide for us. And again, our hesitancy, there really are two reasons why we did not add up the numbers. The first one, as I indicated just a moment ago, is that there are differences. I mean, a wetland restored, you know, is not necessarily the same wetland restored on a different program. You'd be careful about assuming they're all the same. Back to a comment by the chair as part of the Wetland Conservation Act discussion. Be careful about comparing them as being all the same. There's also some amount of double counting of some of these acres. We did not take the effort or the time to go through and ferret out where that double counting may in fact occur to ensure that 1 acre shows up only once in these numbers. Right now we can't guarantee that. But the other thing that I think is an important point to give some thought to is to the degree it's appropriate to have in concept or in reality to have conservation acres compensate for regulatory impacts. And I think that's something that requires some attention if there is some thought of looking at what happens under WAC in the context, what happens in the global view of state and federal programs. But I think just to look at the table now that you have in front of you is if you look at those conservation programs and they start, you know, where you see USDA on the left-hand side and go down, those are the conservation programs. And you will see the numbers there are much larger than what you see on the regulatory side. They're much bigger numbers, which leads us to conclude that if you do, you know, kind of wipe out the boundaries of program that Minnesota is moving towards a net gain of the data that we in fact have. But again, the charge we are presented with is looking only at the Wetland Conservation Act and what can we do to more closely align with no net loss within the context of that regulatory program.
Senator Dill, I think this next discussion we're going to have is going to help you out a lot more. but go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this is what I was asking Mr. Wyrens for earlier, and he was a little slow to give it to us, but I just quickly added this up in my head, and it looks like about 185,000 acres gained during this three-year period. And I don't know why these totals weren't total, why I had to do the arithmetic myself, but then on the loss side, it comes up to around 16,000 acres lost. So we can run around talking about how bad it is in Minnesota where we've, for heaven's sakes, we lost 1,367 acres of wetlands in 3 years. Isn't that terrible? And isn't it, just to provide a balanced picture, you really should be talking about all these wetlands that were gained.
Senator Dill, I think he just ran down the list of caveats to this list as to why he didn't add them up.
That's a good point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
for the
committee.
Lee Fanmuller, DNR, welcome. We've got to give 45 minutes to Senator Kubley, so we've got until about 2 o'clock to talk with you.
Got a handout. Excuse me, Kevin Brown. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lee Fanmuller from the Department of Natural Resources. And chitting today, Doug Norris from our staff is going to be here but had a late emergency, so do nearly as comprehensive a job as he did. I've got a handout coming around that I'm going to walk through real quickly. Basically, it does help address, I hope, a lot of the questions that members just had about how we do know or don't know what the status of wetlands are in Minnesota. It is our, under statutory Minnesota statutes, there is a goal of achieving no net loss in the quantity, quality, and biological diversity of Minnesota wetlands. And the discussion you were just having points to the challenge that we have and how do we really answer whether or not we're achieving that goal. And we don't have a comprehensive system, as Mr. Wyrens pointed out, to really do that in a very good, statistically sound way. So what we've developed is, a few years ago, we received a grant. And when I say we, we've got an interagency wetland group that works with Bowser staff, DNR staff, agriculture staff, and Fish and Wildlife Service. And this group has been meeting for many years dealing with a whole variety of wetland issues. And the question that's at the table is one that this group has been dealing with, is how do we actually document what the status of Minnesota wetlands are? So a few years ago, we secured a major grant from the Environmental Protection Agency to do a study to look at how we can statistically put together a sound program to really monitor Minnesota's wetlands. And with the report for that was just done last July, and it outlined a number of different things. And what we are really trying to do is our overall goal, as you see in the slide in the lower right, is to do and achieve an ongoing assessment of the statewide status and trends in wetland quantity and wetland quality. If you go to the next page, we'll talk a little bit about how we got there. If you look at the second slide in the upper right, it outlines the overall strategy components, which is to do a stratified random sample using aerial photography of Minnesota wetlands, to map all the wetlands within the units that we sample, to do quality assessments in a subset of those, and then also to do an electronic permitting and integrated accounting system so we can keep track of it. And broadly, what the next series of slides do is what we found we needed to do was sample 4,990 square mile plots distributed randomly across the state. And we had enough money to sample a third of those every year. And in addition, we're sampling 250 of those plots, the same plots every year. So overall, in a three-year period, we will assess, do aerial photography on approximately 5,000 square mile plots. Within each of those square mile plots, we'll have aerial photography and we'll delineate the exact boundaries of every wetland in each of those plots. So at the end of 3 years, because it'll take us 3 years to do the entire state, we'll do a third, a third, and a third. At the end of 3 years, we will have a complete baseline information from which we can then, in future years, detect changes. So maybe I'll stop there first to see if there's any questions about that overall method.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are these random samplings of private land, public land, both?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sumpf, they're regardless of ownership. And, of course, the information about exactly whose land it is, we're not providing detailed information on that. It's only meant to be for the monitoring project.
And just quickly, Mr. Chairman, how were they picked?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, it's a random sample design, so it's a statistical design that's set up. There's no other factor other than just to randomly distribute 5,000 plots across Minnesota. They did do a little bit of stratification based on where the wetlands occur in the state, but it's primarily a stratified random sample. So it's a statistically based sample. There are no other quality parameters that went into it.
Thank you.
If you look on the third page in the lower right, page 3, there's a slide that's sampled B. It delineates exactly what we're going to map in each of those wetlands. So you see the wetland classes. We'll be delineating emergent wetlands, forested wetlands, shrub, scrub, deep water wetlands, and then we'll also do generally some non-wetland classes. Basically, what we started this project with an EPA grant and with some state dollars. For it's costing us about $500,000 a year for 3 years. Our first year sampling was this past summer in 2006. So in 2007 and 2008 will be our second and third year. And at the end of 2008, we will have our baseline information. And then in the next three-year period, from 2009, 10, and 11, we'll be able to go back and we'll resample each of those 5,000 plots and look for any change. And that change will allow us to answer the question, at least during that time period, have we seen a net loss or a net gain? We're set up to repeat that every 3 years. So it's only giving us data back through the baseline, which will be this year's 2006 through 2008. Though the first 3 years are the most expensive years, and that's why the EPA grant is instrumental, because we'll be doing all the mapping of every single wetland during those first 3 years. During the second 3 years, we'll just be going back and looking for changes, so it's a little bit cheaper for us to do. So I'll stop again, see if there's any questions on the overall sampling design.
Go ahead.
The next few slides on page 4 talk about another major recommendation from the EPA study that was done. Is right now our major information statewide on all wetlands is the National Wetlands Inventory. And what these series of slides do is just show you that the National Wetlands Inventory, which looked at every single wetland in the state, as opposed to our project, which is looking at wetlands in those 5,000 square mile plots, the National Wetlands Inventory still today is our best source of statewide comprehensive information on the distribution and location of wetlands. But the information dates back to the 1970s and 1980s. Most of it is based on satellite imagery that was done in the 1980s. One of the major recommendations in this report was that we should really redo the National Wetlands Inventory. But it's very expensive to do that because it is so comprehensive, and our estimate is that it would cost about $7 million to do that again 30 to 40 years later since when it was first done. We don't have the capital to do that right now. We're really focusing on the wetland monitoring project instead. So that's the next series of slides. Then on the bottom of page 4 in the lower right, the third major recommendation was to also look at a subset of those square mile study plots and try to do some assessment of the quality of the wetlands, not just looking at total acres, but are these wetlands really providing for the full biological diversity of resources that we're trying to protect when we protect wetlands? And this piece is still under development. PCA is taking the lead in this piece and are looking at a number of different floristic and faunal assessments, tools that we can use to subset those 5,000 plots and also look at wetland quality. So that's the third piece. The fourth piece on the last page, page 5, is a piece where Bowser is taking the lead. That's looking at really doing an electronic permitting and accounting system. And they've got, I think, a pilot for that and are bringing that on board in the next couple years. And Bowser staff could talk more detail about that. So that's the real quick overview on where we're headed with this project. And if you have any other further questions, be happy to try to answer them.
Mr. Chairman.
Do you think that, why did you settle on the random sampling as opposed to kind of a more thorough, maybe region by region survey, the National Wetland Inventory, for example? That's a survey of every wetland as opposed to random sampling. How did you settle upon that? Or is that just kind of your first start and then you're going to expand to?
Mr. Chair, the National Wetlands Inventory, which is the inventory of every wetland in the state, it's so expensive to do that you can't detect change very well. And the survey that was done in the 70s and 80s was used with old satellite imagery. And if we were to redo that today, it wouldn't be strictly comparable to the 70s and 80s. So we could come up with a change detection between those two sample periods, but they're not strictly comparable. We'd like to do the National Wetlands Inventory again, but the $7 million price tag, and it still doesn't answer the question of wetland change, is what put it lower on the list. The stratified random sample of the 5,000 plots, the 5,000 number is based on us being able to sample enough sites in the state so that we can say with accuracy that there is change between three-year sampling periods. So the 5,000 is totally based on kind of statistically driven so we can answer the question about change.
And then how do we kind of get on to Senator Dill's topic about whether there are new wetlands being created?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, the way we can answer that is by the change detection. So after the first 3 years, when we delineate everything within the 5,000 square mile study plots, in the next 3 years, we'll be looking at change, which is both loss and gain. So if there are new wetlands created, those will show up as something that didn't show up during the first three-year frame and will be shown as a gain.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Van Mueller, as I was listening to you, you said that you would be delineating all wetlands, but you did, I presume that you meant all wetlands within the statistical sample of plots, not all wetlands in the state.
Yes, correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Further questions? Is that it?
That's it.
Oh, okay. Easy enough. When is this going to be completed?
Well, we're in our first three-year frame for baseline monitoring. We started in 2006, 2007, 2008. So at the end of 2008, we'll have our first baseline. And then at the end of 2011, our second 3 years where we can compare to the first 3 years and show change. So we're way out yet.
Will you have something that you could maybe, something you might be able to show the committee in the next 6 months, year and a half?
Mr. Chair, what we could show in the next year is basically more the results of the first few frames, and it won't be. It'll just give us some sense of where the wetlands are in those sample plots, but it won't tell us anything about change detection.
I think that'd be interesting too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Senator Quigley is on his way. Yep. Senate File 480.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As we take a look at the second generation biofuels bill, I guess, I know that Mr. Knopf has been visited with about a small change in Senate File 480, and I wonder if he could describe that as an oral amendment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman and members, first of all, as long as we're on page one, on line 1.5 of the title, delete authorized rulemaking, semicolon, on line 1.5. Yeah, that's in the title.
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chairman, it would go all the way back to page 7 on line 7.25. Delete the sentence, the board may adopt rules to implement this section.
Could you give the line reference again, Mr. Knapp?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, it's 7.25. It's on page 7, line 7.25. Delete the board may adopt rules to implement this section. And then, Mr. Chairman, on page 10, on 10.9, after the first comma, insert an and delete the second comma and rules. And then on line 10.12, do the same thing. After the first comma, insert and then delete the second comma and rules.
Okay, do we have that? Mr. Scogan, would you like to move that?
I move for the adoption of the amendment.
Discussion? All those
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frederickson.
This is a first engrossment, so I think it would be appropriate that Senator Kubley would give us a brief explanation why he wants to do this.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson and members, primarily it allows the legislature to establish that same function, and it eliminates an additional stop. And this bill already has quite a few stops, so I'm interested in expediting the process.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
It's more than just committee stops. I mean, you're taking out rulemaking completely from the bill, as I understand it. So it probably saves a lot of money and a lot of time beyond Senate process.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I think it's something that the legislature can do when there isn't any additional dollars involved.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, just technically, Mr. Knopp, did you insert the and mm-hmm. before or after? Did you leave the comma in?
Mr. Chairman, I just informed the secretary to go ahead and get rid of that comma, too.
But and both of those
after
places.
Looking at it, I realized there was only two things in the string, so now we don't need the comma
yes.
in both places.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Thanks for catching that.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is primarily broken down into four sections, but primarily it's looking at, the production of energy, both fuel energy and other forms of energy from a cellulosic raw material. So, there are four specific pieces to it. One of them is a bioenergy production that pertains to forms of energy that are not used for fuel. The second one is for the production of a liquid fuel. Then the third section is just looking at the Minnesota's RIM program, and specifically at clean energy portion. And then looking at some equipment loans for some of the RIM lands. You know, if you're going to be raising some of this material, you need specialized equipment, and it's intended to help a producer to make that transition. Then just starting off, Mr. Chair and members, looking at the different pieces, once again, the intent is to develop biofuels from cellulosic raw materials and develop a stream of that raw material that would help the state move toward energy independence and hopefully, have some of the product for export as well as we take a look at this. But it's a step-by-step approach that looks at the markets that we already have and trying to establish a source of ongoing raw materials for this kind of production, so that as the technology develops, the utilization will be capable of being put into place fairly quickly here in the state of Minnesota. you know, some of this technology is already in existence, Mr. Chair, and some of it I think we're a little ways away from it yet. But it gives us the opportunity to, you know, put some things in place legislatively that would allow the industry to move ahead fairly quickly when the technology for the other portions are available as well. On the bioenergy part, you know, there is both in the bioenergy and the biofuels part a two-tiered system of payments under the bioenergy portion. It would pay 75 cents per million BTUs for 3 years to a facility that uses a cellulosic raw material to convert into another form of power. An example of this might be an ethanol plant that decides to generate some of their own energy, Mr. Chair, and members. You know, they may be using a corn stover or, you know, some other row crop to convert the biomass to a synthetic gas that they would then use to replace some of the natural gas that they're currently purchasing on the market. And to use cellulosic material does have the side effect of reducing the carbon emissions, which is one of the benefits of using that material. Then the second tier, it looks at making a payment that is twice that size at $1.50 per million BTUs, and that could be for a 10-year period. But looking at the raw material that has that cellulose component in it, that it comes from a polyculture of different grasses that would be consistent with meeting the standards for what can be raised on rim grounds. So, you know, I think for some of this portion of the bill, Mr. Chair, or maybe even all of it, I guess I'm aware that some of the technology at least is currently available, that we could potentially see this coming online fairly quickly for this particular portion. On the next portion, I do think we're a little bit ways away yet, but the biofuels portion of the bill that starts with Section 2, we're looking at having a goal here that is roughly the same as we have in the generation of electricity. We'd like to see a quarter of the biofuels come from this raw material that has a cellulosic base. And, looking at a biofuel here in the state that would then reach a level of production of at least 60 million gallons and will extend the time period out to 2015 or until we reach that 60 million gallon level. And that, I think, it does send a signal that, the facility should be sited here in the state, and that's our intent. I think one of the strongest components of this bill, members, is that the one of local ownership. Some of you are acquainted with the work of Dr. Kildegard out at the University of Minnesota at Morris, whose work details how local ownership impacts a local community economically. He says that it's roughly 5.5 to 1 if you have local ownership over having ownership that might exist in another state. And so while we don't want to, we don't want to totally disregard our neighbors to the west and south and east and possibly even the north, I guess we hadn't talked about that possibility, but we are looking at forming it in a way that encourages the production here in Minnesota. Once again, it has a two-tiered structure on the payments. There's a payment of 15 cents a gallon for 5 years to a facility that's converting that raw material into a liquid transportation fuel up to a maximum, I believe it is, of 15 million gallons per facility, and that provides incentives rather close by for using materials that could be converted to a liquid fuel that you know, has its sites here in Minnesota, but uses the same kinds of materials that are listed in the bioenergy portion for the 75 cent per million BTUs payment. Then the second tier again, once again, goes back to the polyculture of native and perennial prairie grasses that, you know, once again, meet the standards for the clean energy REM lands and can be used as a transportation fuel. But the payment goes to 30 cents there, and the time structure goes out three more years as well. But we do intend to provide those incentives for the perennials, at least. You know, the research that's been done by Dr. Tillman and Dr. Hill at the University of Minnesota indicates that we get a much larger return in terms of the ethanol produced from using a mixture of perennial prairie grasses than you get from corn alone. We know that there's research going on corn in terms of its genetic structure that will allow us to gain another 40% to 50% of the fuel that we currently derive from corn-based ethanol alone. But Tillman and Hill have pretty much documented in their research, I think, that we will get at least 240% more ethanol per acre from the use of this mixture of prairie grasses than we can currently get from corn-based ethanol. And that line has not really leveled off. I know that some of you were in the Ag Committee when Dr. Tillman and Hill made a presentation there, and that curve doesn't level off so far. You know, they're 10 years into their research and intend to continue that. But, you know, they're currently at 240% on a per-acre basis, and, you know, it doesn't look like it's ready to level off right now. You know, it may take a gentler curve, but it's going up at about a 45-degree angle in the years that they've tested the plot that they have in their research. You know, this bill does contain some money that would continue that research on a more commercial scale, and I would hope that that's a piece that we can preserve as well, Mr. Chair. I know there's it's listed in the bill as being at MESA, and I know the U is interested in getting it into their IRE program as well, so I don't know. We may need to visit with them a bit on that. But then the Reinvest in Minnesota Clean Energy Program, you know, sets aside some of the REM acres, and you know, these are, you know, really smaller component pieces, and yet that doesn't mean they're unimportant. I do think the production incentives for bioenergy and biofuels are probably the major portions of the bill, but these last two sections that deal with the REM lands and the capital equipment loans would help us in making a transition to fuels that are based on, you know, cellulosic raw materials that moves beyond corn-based ethanol production alone. With me is Mr. Don Arnasty, and if the committee likes, he could make a couple of comments on those last two sections particularly.
Welcome, Mr. Arnasty. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Arnasty. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, which is one of the member organizations of Clean Energy Minnesota. If a page could distribute this, there's a sheet here that Clean Energy Minnesota put together. At the bottom, you will note the 13 member organizations of Clean Energy Minnesota. Many of them are organizations you're familiar with. The member organizations of Clean Energy Minnesota worked very hard with a variety of partners, friends, and organizations to draw together the concepts that form the basis of this bill. We were pleased to work with farm organizations, rural economic development groups, farmers, and other people interested in the next generation of biofuels. One of the things that I think is important for the committee to bear in mind is that change is happening in terms of both the energy sources that our country is pursuing, as well as our agricultural production systems. And we believe this bill is an opportunity for Minnesota to lead and move out front in both of these avenues, putting on the ground and in place the good research that actually Minnesota has been developing here at our university and other places. Some of the researchers that Senator Kubley was mentioning have been doing their research right here in Minnesota for 10 or 15 years. We think this bill is an important opportunity to move Minnesota out front and position ourselves to potentially receive matching funds through a federal farm program, much like we did successfully under CREP. But I think this is so this is both a next-generation energy bill, but I think it's also a next-generation agriculture bill. And the RIM-RE section, I believe that's Section 4 that Senator Kubley just mentioned, is a key area that I think the committee might want to focus on. In it, we are proposing that the legislature appropriate sufficient bonding to probably establish about 10,000 acres of easements on working agricultural land. And what's very different about this program, the RIM name is very familiar to you, and people think of it as a conservation set-aside of either temporary or permanent nature. What's being proposed here is something a little different. This is about a contract or an agreement with a farmer, a willing landowner, just like all the other RIM programs, that have to do with working agricultural lands. And what the RIM-RE section is laying out is the vision that we can do active, economically viable agriculture on lands that are of high conservation value, that we can take a degraded farmland or perhaps a wet field or some things of this nature. We can establish mixed native perennial grasses and other appropriate plants, and we can see clean water benefits. We can see tremendous wildlife benefits, and we can help work on some of our other problems that I know this committee grapples with. I know that there are organizations and individuals coming before you asking, for example, for restoration of wetlands. And there are others that are looking for cleanup of our waterways, and particularly in our agricultural regions of the state, we have a lot of water quality issues, but really all over the state. We believe this small program, RIM-RE, Section 4 in this bill, while it perhaps will directly only impact 10,000 acres or so were it to be funded, it has two potentials. One is to set a model of a third crop or an additional way to do perennial cropping on agricultural lands to serve our public purpose of trying to develop the next generation of biofuels, providing farmers with a steady stream of income and allow clean water and wildlife benefits to be available to everybody. So we believe that it's really, really important that while it is small in terms of its initial footprint, it has the opportunity to be amplified by the federal farm program. And it most importantly, it provides a model of maybe a new way for energy production as well as environmental protection and cleanup. But with that, I'd be happy to stop my comments so that there's plenty of time for the other folks who have traveled here to testify.
Questions for Mr. Arnosti? Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to grasp all of this, because and a couple thoughts crossed my mind, and maybe some of the others might be able to address it, too. I don't have any problem with Sections 10 and 11, having seen a little bit of what the research is going on over at the university. I was on the Agri-Growth Council tour this late summer and had a chance to see some of the exciting things that are happening there. But it seems to me that we're not quite at the stage yet to be going full hog into setting up production. And it looks like we need to invest some more so that we can get this to the point of the viability and the recommendations of how this would in fact take place. Now, perhaps the Section 4 with the the task force or the whatever it was, the technical committee, and a few others of it would be appropriate now. But the other thing I was grappling with when you were discussing the whole setup of the subsidy, in times past when we were discussing biodiesel and also seeing what's happening with the demand for ethanol by virtue of the fact that we now we have a mandate and the competition was proving to be environmentally undesirable. So it really gave a the market was there. And I'm just questioning whether when just because we're using a different material, when we have a mandate, do we need the subsidy? Because it seems to me you need the subsidy to get something going if you don't have the mandate. But if you have the mandate, that drives the market, and you you shouldn't have to have the subsidy. So that's kind of what's rolling around in my mind, if you want to address that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I guess from my perspective, and Mr. Arnasti may like to respond as well, it does seem to me that there are not any producers out there who are currently producing a significant amount of this kind of blend of prairie grasses or, other forms of biomass like that as a polyculture as a commercial crop. And so it would aid in that transition. I'm not sure that you could get people to move from a crop where they know they can make a profit to one where they aren't too sure unless you have a market for it. And as you stated, I do think that we are a little ways away. I'm not sure we're as far away as some people believe we are, but I think we are a little ways away from having a commercial application for this second generation of ethanol production, particularly. The bioenergy piece is currently available. But, I'm not sure that the industry would get the kind of start that it needs in the state without some kind of incentive for a producer to go to a crop that does not currently have that kind of commercial
Well, Mr. Chairman, I that probably is more within the jurisdiction of the Ag Committee than the Environment Committee at this point in terms of what incentive it would take. But from what I understand, a lot of this production could, if you in fact could get the agreement that some of the set-aside lands for which they're already being paid, the RIM and CREP lands, that you would in fact be generating additional income from something that's already there, or could be cultivated and not be inconsistent with that environmental protection. I mean, what's there not to like for a farmer? I think they're smarter than we give them credit for if they wouldn't see the opportunity if we can clear some of those other hurdles out of the way.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, you raise good points, and it is true that there are many things that are unknown about this. We do believe that it is very important, though, for the legislature and the public to help lead in the development of this new emerging industry. And a dozen or 14 years ago, Minnesota walked the plank in terms of proving that liquid transportation fuel could be made out of an agricultural crop. And I think we could have had a lot of those discussions, and did indeed have a lot of those discussions a dozen or 14 years ago about, is now the right time to move forward, or should we wait to and do some research, for example, but wait to see the evolution of the private sector and the research and all of that. I think we're trying to learn from that. That was a very successful incentive program that Minnesota did. It helped a lot with rural economic development. It helped a lot with adding value to our corn crop. It helped a lot in terms of the local communities that did invest in those plants. We're trying to incorporate now in this next generation of fuels. It is recognized across the nation that we do not and will not have enough corn to produce the kind of fuel that the president is calling for and many others are calling for. And so it is very necessary as a nation for us to move into these types of feedstocks. The question is Minnesota going to be out front and capitalize on the investments we've already made in research, or are we going to wait and perhaps see investments in these additional next-generation plants happen in other states, and with us trying to play catch-up later? We think there's two reasons to move forward, both the rural economic development piece that I just alluded to, but also the fact that we have the experience of incentivizing the first generation of ethanol. We've learned from that to a certain extent that we'd like to add in water quality and wildlife benefits to this generation, and we believe we can with these crops. And so what is being proposed today is that basically the state put up sufficient funding once the framework of the program is laid out by the technical committee to do 10,000 acres of incentives for farmers. That's enough to point the way. You can think of it as a pilot program. That does not transform the landscape. That really is taking the research and rolling it out. But we think it's a very, very important statement that would be made both to the federal folks who are writing the Farm Bill, and Senator Vickerman took the initiative to send a letter off last month to representatives and senators in Washington that are writing that federal Farm Bill and asked that they bear in mind the policy work that we're doing here. I think he's looking to do that kind of 4 or 5 to 1 matching that happened under CREP. So we have the opportunity to become known as the center of innovation for this next generation of biofuels. And I think actually this is a prudent and cautious step. It's not proposing 3 million acres of transformation, which they can do with a stroke of the pen in Washington. It's proposing 10,000 acres of incentives to farmers. And I feel pretty certain that there are people there. In fact, some of the people testifying might tell you that they're interested in this.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, the difference is that at that time there was a requirement of an oxygenate for fuel. It didn't say where it came from. And I think we were trying to lead that into the agricultural versus the chemical, the byproduct of existing crude to actually create that oxygenate. So that I think there's the uncertainty of the viability of ethanol back at that point certainly drove that. Right now, I think what would build the greater comfort is the greater investment at the research level of getting us to a point to say this really does work. Build it beyond just the initial thing so that there is a small-scale production that proves the points that you've been making here, and I think people would leap to it. That's all that I'm saying to.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if I get in the discussion, too, for just a second, listening to your questions and kind of your argument about this, I think 15 years ago when we started the ethanol program, we knew how to grow corn. We could grow lots of corn. The question was whether or not we could successfully convert it into ethanol. With this program, I think there's two question marks. Number one, can we produce enough native prairie vegetative material and harvest it to make it successful? And then there's a second variable, are we going to have the technology to turn that cellulose into ethanol? So I think rather than one unknown, not in this program, we have two. And I think perhaps this requires a little extra push to make it successful.
More research. Well, Mr. Chairman, it needs to be some more research is what you're telling me.
And some incentives.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, members, just remember that this is not going to be the whole solution. We've got to have corn to go with it because we're quite a few years out before we get to the cellulose. It's just one of those two combinations. I'll bet you my farmers can raise more corn than you can use.
Well,
farmers in Minnesota, the
national corn growers say that perhaps half of what the president set out as national targets for ethanol could be produced if we utilized all the corn in the country. All the corn that would be available without disrupting
other
things.
Mr. Chairman, the minute the Board of Trade came out and said there's going to be a shortage of take that much corn has jumped per $1 since it's getting up per $5.
Lots of people to hear from today. Senator Ingebrigtsen, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions, maybe a comment. Senator Kubel, you said 240% better production off of 1 acre of this versus corn. Is that what the first testing is talking about?
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that there is a substantial increase in the number of gallons per acre that can be achieved under the Tillman Hill model.
Home farms are
fall off?
And it hasn't leveled off. I asked, you know, in committee, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, you know, where that might end. They said they didn't know, you know, it'll be at least that.
Just a follow-up, please. Yeah, that's pretty encouraging. That's pretty exciting, quite frankly. And isn't this not a program more of an incentive, as you were talking about, versus a mandate? There's no mandates here. This is an incentive to get this going, and it's certainly going to add to our not having to rely on everybody else for fossil fuel oils.
Well, when Mr. Arnasty was speaking, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, currently we get, you know, a fairly small percentage of the nation's fuel supply from ethanol. And when all of the plants that are under construction are finished, we'll use about 35% of the nation's corn supply to supply, you know, 5 to 6% of our fuel needs. But if you look at, you know, using a cellulosic raw material, you're looking at bumping it up there over 50%. You know, it seems to me that you can go a lot further toward establishing our own national security, if you want to call it that, by producing liquid fuels from sources other than corn. And I think, you know, we're going to have corn-based ethanol production for some time. But when you can grow this cellulosic raw material on ground that really isn't fit to grow some other crops on, you know, it seems to me that you've got a win-win situation in which, you know, you might see prices drop back a bit, which would be good for the livestock producers, but you'd also see a new source of revenue for the agricultural community in providing a crop that could be grown on lands that are not suitable for a large number of other crops at any rate. And if you can grow half of your fuel supply on the same number of acres that you currently use for, you know, using about 10% of that, well, it would seem to me that it would be a good move to try and incentivize that and get it kicked off in a way that was similar to what we did with corn-based ethanol.
Senator Olson, and then we will move on.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, Minnesota, I think, was maybe the only or the earliest state to mandate that the oxygenate we would use would be ethanol. And then last session, we mandated it up to 20%. So that's what I meant by mandate.
Okay. Senator Coobley.
Yes.
Carry
Thank
on.
You.
Well, yeah, well, we do have a number of other another people who would like to testify, Mr. Chair, and Linda Meschke is seated on my left, and you know, we'll go to her next and then go to Professor Jordan.
Ms. Meschke, please identify yourself. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Meschke. That's spelled M-E-S-C-H-K-E for the record. I am president of a nonprofit corporation located in Fairmont, Minnesota, called Rural Advantage. I have been involved with agriculture all of my life and with water quality issues in South Central Minnesota for the last 19 years. I would like to urge your support of Senate File 480. While I support all of the initiatives in the legislation, I would like to take a few minutes to point out benefits in addition to renewable energy for Minnesota from this legislation. As several of you are aware, I have been promoting the establishment of third crops on the landscape to reduce pollution loading from agricultural non-point source pollution for the last 6 years. By third crops, I mean a wide range of crops other than corn and soybeans, not just one additional crops. These crops should be working lands and provide revenue back to the farm family, not land retirement. In my vision, these crops would be strategically placed in the landscape on the most environmentally sensitive lands. Perennials grown for biofuels are a third crop. Not only can they provide biofuels, but they can also provide protection for soil erosion, nutrient reduction, wildlife habitat, and carbon sequestration to reduce climate change. As cellulosic biofuels develop, they can provide a new market for perennials planted on the landscape. I have found that even in our intense corn and soybean area of South Central Minnesota, that farmers are willing to grow other crops. If the crops can economically compare to corn and soybeans, farmers will be willing to grow them. Through a combination of biomass payments, lower input costs, and environmental commodity payments such as carbon, water quality trading of nitrogen and phosphorus, improved habitat, aquifer recharge, sustainability certificates, and the Conservation Security Program, biomass for biofuels can compete with corn economically. As we move forward, we need to think about renewable energy in this context and these multiple benefits. By placing perennials such as native prairie mixes in the landscape, we can significantly reduce agricultural non-point source pollution. In the Medillia area, where I am working with several partners to develop a model that can show how we can leverage multiple benefits from biomass crops, the Medillia model looks at a 25-mile radius around Medillia to supply enough biomass to fuel the community. There are 1.9 million acres in annual row crops of corn and soybeans in this area. We are targeting the most environmentally sensitive areas, about 20% of the landscape in this Medillia site. These are areas with erosive soils, steeper slopes, close proximity to surface waters, and drainage characteristics, whether they're droughty or too wet. A local renewable energy facility and eco-industrial park would supply a local market for these crops. The land that is highly productive could remain in corn and soybean production. The land that is more marginal or environmentally sensitive would be converted to perennial or non-row crops. In Minnesota, we need to think beyond corn grain or stover to ethanol and leverage the existing renewable energy interest to bring additional federal resources to the state and provide multiple ecological and economic benefits. This legislation supports systems that can use multiple biomass supplies and low water processes. In return, we receive multiple ecological services, including improved water quality. If the Medillia model were fully implemented, we could solve the agricultural non-point source pollution issues in the region. This means we have a sustainable, renewable energy system supported with a more sustainable farm system, improved water quality, vibrant rural communities, and economically viable rural families. Senate File 480 supports these principles with incentives to develop more sustainable biofuels, provides a mechanism to reduce economic risk to farmers who are early adopters of cellulosic plantings, and supports the development of the infrastructure to support a cellulosic renewable energy system. We can have a more sustainable renewable energy system that does not put our drinking water supply, water quality, and other environmental factors at risk. We are in a position to be a leader for a new paradigm with renewable energy, and this bill is a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Meschke? Senator Kubley? Back to you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll go to Professor Jordan.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, certainly. My name is Nick Jordan. I am a faculty member in the Agronomy and Plant Genetics Department at the University of Minnesota. And with colleagues, I work on the development of what we've heard called working landscapes in this hearing. In other words, agricultural landscapes where both agricultural commodities are being produced as well as other beneficial things such as wildlife habitat and better water. And it's certainly my pleasure to be here today to offer a few comments from the from an agricultural science perspective on what we do and do not know. And I'd like to take as a point of departure the picture that was painted by Linda Meschke a moment ago. What you heard her say was that there is something like 20% of a landscape, say around southern Minnesota, that we can identify as being environmentally sensitive for one reason or another. And in particular, not a good place to really grow the current kinds of crops that we might be trying to raise in those places, such as corn and soybeans and other annual species. So these are the good places to put, if you were, perennial plants on a landscape, in that 20% where we know it will really do some good. Now, we can say, on the basis of the scientific evidence base, I think, that there's no question that the kinds of benefits that we've heard about in terms of wildlife habitat, in terms of managing the quality and quantity of water, and providing other sorts of environmental services such as recreational and tourism opportunities, perennial plants can do those things. It's also clear from the scientific evidence that perennial plants can produce reasonably abundant yields of biomass for the production of energy from cellulosic sources. Where things become less clear is how exactly we should arrange these perennial plants across the landscape, if you will. In other words, where should we put which plants for what purposes exactly? And to give you an example of the sort of question that arises, right now, the conservation community, I think it's fair to say, is somewhat concerned about the vision of CRP lands being used to harvest cellulosic biomass from. And their concern, which is understandable, is that wildlife habitat quality would be damaged by that. However, if we think about a scenario in which a much larger part of the landscape, not just scattered islands of CRP lands, but in fact a much larger part of the landscape were to be occupied by perennial plants, then we have, you know, quite a different possibility. First of all, it would be presumably possible to go in and harvest a fraction of that part of the landscape, a large part of that landscape, without really damaging wildlife populations, because you'd have a bigger base, and so you can take a reasonable percentage of that out and still leave enough habitat intact to provide refuges and shelters for key wildlife species. Now, that it's I think a fair summary of what we do and do not understand scientifically to say that that's about where we stand. And so what's needed now, it's my judgment and that of, I think it's a generally recognized in the field, that what's needed now are experiments on a considerably larger scale than we've really been able to do before. In other words, to convince my colleagues at the DNR, who are a little skeptical that their conservation mandates can be met in these sort of working landscapes, that that might actually be true, we need to try it out. We need to pick some landscapes. We need to put perennial plants on that 20% of the landscape where they can do the most good. And then we need to study the wildlife populations. We can expect more wildlife. That's clear. We know that when we take biomass away, we're going to do some damage to that wildlife. How do we balance those two things? That's the question. That's really the scientific question at this point. And there isn't any way to find that out without doing experiments on a considerably larger scale than what we've been able to do so far. So it's, I think my overall recommendation is to endorse scaling up to moderate kind of scale pilot or demonstration projects where we have the opportunity to really study scientifically how to key things like the sheltering of wildlife populations, how to key processes like how does, when we have a 9-inch rainfall, how does that tremendous potential flood damage get sort of held in check by perennial plants? These are the things we don't know and we can't find out until we do experiments on a larger scale.
Questions for Mr. Jordan? Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, and perhaps, Professor, you have some insight into this, but it seems to me, and I'm not real familiar with cellulosic energy, but it seems to me that I've heard that there would be a significant decrease in the amount of pesticides and fertilizers that are used in the production, and I was wondering if you had any insight into that, if I'm right in thinking that, or if that's not necessarily the case, or if we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Senator Stephen. I think that it's very important to say that native perennial plants, which are the plants that are really at issue in this bill, are likely to require lower inputs of fertilizers and pesticides, particularly when they're grown in mixtures, not necessarily polycultures, but imagine monocultures mixed together in a field. So you might have a strip of one native species for 50 yards and then a strip of another. Those kinds of arrangements we certainly know are effective in both controlling how pests are a problem, limiting pest problems, therefore limiting pesticide use, and also in limiting the amount of fertilizer that needs to be used. So I would say that the scientific evidence does not suggest that that greater those inputs, which can be environmentally damaging, would increase in this scenario.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Chair and Senator Sabin, I think, you know, having been on a number of plots where the native prairie is still in existence, I think you'll find that as native prairie is reestablished in Minnesota, that it basically crowds out the weeds that we use herbicides on today. And it would seem to me that that over a span of time, and I'm not sure how much time we're talking about, but that you would in fact eliminate the need for herbicides. You know, for instance, you know, I've never seen a Canadian thistle, which is a primary culprit in consumption of herbicides in the countryside. You know, I've never seen one on native prairie. You know, the plant mass is just too dense, and the root structure is too dense, and those kinds of invaders get crowded out. And you know, just to by way of an example, to give you kind of a visual picture of that, you know, the path that leads alongside one side of this one particular plot of native prairie I'm thinking about, you know, has Canadian thistles growing right up to the edge of that native prairie. But once you get into the prairie, you can't find them at all. So, you know, it would seem to me that Dr. Jordan's comments are accurate, that you would require substantially fewer inputs over a period of time.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Professor. Senator Kubley, back to you.
Well, we have with us today Mr. Paul Kramer from Coda Energy, and he has an interesting project afoot with his company that he'd like to tell you about.
Welcome, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Kramer from Coda Energy. Coda Energy is a combined heat and power plant that fueled 100% by a biomass that will be built in Shakopee, Minnesota. Coda Energy is a partnership between Rahr Malting Company. Rahr Malting is a family-owned company that's been in the malting business since 1847. It's our 160th year now. And the other partner is a Shakopee Mindawakan Sioux community, a little older family than Rahr Malting. The name Coda Energy actually is from the Lakota language. It means friendly. Rahr Malting Company facility in Shakopee is the largest malt production facility in the world. It converts over 20 million bushels of barley into malt for food and beverage industry yearly. Just to give you an idea of the quantity of barley we process in Shakopee, you'd have to plant barley on every square inch of Hennepin County to equal the volume of barley that we utilize in a year. The malting process requires a tremendous quantity of energy resources. Rahr Malting currently uses natural gas volume equal to that needed by 11,000 homes per year. It also consumes electricity equal to that required for 7,000 homes per year. The Coda Energy project was born out of the desire to stay in business as a malting company in Shakopee, Minnesota. And to do so, we had to find a way to control costs in an environmentally responsible and, just as importantly, sustainable manner. Rahr's partners, the Shakopee Mindawakan Sioux community, saw an opportunity to fulfill their desire to produce clean, sustainable, renewable energy through this partnership. By using agricultural byproducts from our own malting operation and other agricultural-based products located within 50-mile radius of our plant in Shakopee, enough renewable fuel is available to operate Coda. Coda Energy will produce 16.5 megawatts of baseload renewable energy. This is enough electricity for 16,000 homes, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Coda Energy will also provide Rahr Malting Company steam that will totally eliminate the use of natural gas at the Rahr Malting Company facility. To do this, we will need 175,000 tons of agricultural byproducts a year. And our goal is to use 50,000 tons per year of dedicated energy crops, with switchgrass being the ideal fuel for our process. Our plant, the Coda Energy plant, is currently in the permitting process at the MPCA, and we intend to begin construction as soon as the permit is approved. And our goal is to be operational late spring of 2008. Obviously, we need a program in place to grow energy crops and to promote the use of agricultural byproducts to produce energy. We feel that this biofuels legislation will enable this to happen. This bill will stimulate the production of energy crops and the technology to distribute both the energy crops and the agricultural byproducts to the energy producers, such as Coda Energy. Our location in the Minnesota River Valley is an ideal location for this type of project to be built. The incentives in this bill in the form of payments per MMBTU from agricultural products used for energy production will ensure that Coda Energy and other bioenergy facilities in the future will be built. Bioenergy is the field of dreams, and this bill will promote the development of the state's biofuel infrastructure. Without this bill, the future implementation of new bioenergy technologies such as cellulosic ethanol will be difficult simply because the infrastructure for agri-fuel production and delivery won't be ready. This bill is critical for the success of Coda Energy, and I think Coda Energy is critical for Minnesota. Coda Energy will be a tremendous economic benefit for Minnesota. This is a $55 million investment in the Minnesota economy that the two private entities are making. Coda Energy will create new jobs with an annual payroll of over $750,000 per year. Coda Energy will annually inject over $6 million into the local state agricultural economy for biofuels purposes. This is money that we currently send to gas producers in Oklahoma, Texas, or Alberta, Canada, and also it goes to the people that mine coal in Wyoming. All that money is going to stay here to people that we deal with every day in a 50-mile radius of Shakopee. Also, it'll protect 100 existing jobs at the Rohr Malting Company facility in Shakopee, Minnesota. It'll also create new jobs to support the biofuel industry, both in the production and delivery. Coda Energy is also a very tremendous environmental benefit to the state of Minnesota. The 16.5 megawatts of electrical production will reduce CO2 emissions by over 190,000 tons per year versus coal-fired electrical generation, and will emit no mercury in doing so.
Mr. Kramer, I apologize, but I just need you to summarize, please.
Okay.
We have two more testifiers, and we'd like to take a vote here in the next 8 minutes. So.
Okay. I'd just like to say it's an environmentally responsible project, and this bill is important for our project. And it's important for the agricultural community.
I appreciate your brevity. Thank you. Any questions? Back to you, Senator Kubley.
Okay, well, we have Gary Botzek, who has worked with a lot of conservation groups in Minnesota, and we'll give him a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I notice I'm on the agenda twice. I'll not only testify just once, but I'll also be very brief. Thank you for including me. I'm here representing the Minnesota Conservation Federation and Audubon, Minnesota, and it's not every day that those two organizations see eye to eye, or where they do see eye to eye is on habitat, and habitat. And this bill, this proposal, this legislation is very important toward the next generation of habitat. These working lands that we're discussing will become working conservation. They're not only good for the farmer. They're also good for the conservationists, whether you're a bird watcher or a bird hunter. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that this is a major step in the right direction, the future of our energy policy, our conservation policy, and our economic development policy is all wrapped up in this legislation. So we urge you to support this legislation for a number of reasons, but do look at this from a hunter's perspective and an environmentalist perspective. With that, I'll close, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Mr. Botzek? Thank you very much. And finally, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a new testifier from the Minnesota Society for Conservation Biology, and I believe you have a handout on his testimony as well. Mr. Tix.
Welcome, and please identify yourself.
My name is Dan Tix. I'm an ecologist at Great River Greening, but I'm here as a member of the Minnesota Society for Conservation Biology. The Society is an international professional organization dedicated to scientific study of the maintenance of biological diversity on Earth. And we are primarily made up of natural resources professionals interested in conservation and the study of biological diversity, including resource managers, educators, government agency employees, and private conservation scientists. In support of this bill, we strongly feel that it is critical for the natural resources of the state, for water quality, for wildlife habitat. But you've already heard a lot about that. One concern that we do have with the future of cellulosic ethanol production is the use of non-native, single-species, monocrop, and genetically modified organisms, such as hybrid switchgrass and other organisms that are of non-local ecotype. And those concerns are primarily based on invasive species potential. Invasive species are seriously currently degrading natural resources in Minnesota, especially water quality, but also the management of those invasive species, such as something like reed canary grass in our wetlands, crowds out other native species, reduces wildlife habitat, and it reduces the functions of native, diverse ecosystems. So in support of this bill, we have several provisions that we feel are necessary component of the bill and must remain and should be established before large-scale biomass fuels production is underway. And that is, I'm going to pick out a few of them, a few of our provisions that I find most compelling. That first, there's a commitment to utilizing native species of local origin, recognizing that these plants are the best adapted to local conditions and that they're planted in polyculture. Two, that there's a commitment to planting and sustaining diverse communities of plants rather than monocultures, and recognizing the emerging science out of the University of Minnesota facilities. Three, that there's a commitment to balancing the needs of wildlife and ecosystem services with biofuels production. This would be achieved through ongoing research and monitoring. Also that there's adequate funding for such research, technical assistance, and adaptive management. And finally, that there is establishment of cellulosic fuels target as a component of the Minnesota Renewable Fuels Standard. And with that, I'd just like to again wage my support for this bill and ask you to pass it in the upcoming session.
Senator Kubley, were you aware of their concerns regarding GMOs and other types of grasses?
I'm sorry, Ms. Chair, I didn't catch it.
Were you aware of their concerns?
I just received this information the same time that you did, Ms. Chair. I just got it today, too. But
other questions for Mr. Tix? Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just move the bill. I don't know if there's any more discussion, but I'd like to move that. Does it go to the Energy Committee next?
Energy Policy Committee?
Yeah, I'd like to move that Senate File 480 as amended be recommended to pass referred to the Committee on Energy.
Other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Chairman, there's one.
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you could, there was one other section that referred to rules. If you look at page 10, it's the appropriation language. And I think to be consistent with the earlier adopted amendment, if on line 10.16, delete the third comma and insert and. And on 10.17, delete comma and rules. And that would just be consistent with the earlier adopted amendment, the one that was found later.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that amendment.
Maybe I should withdraw my amendment, Mr. Chair. Or can I incorporate it?
You can just leave it on the table.
I can just leave it on the table?
Leave it on the table.
Okay, go ahead then.
Senator Fredrickson, you move that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I do.
All those in favor of the amendments, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Back to you, Senator Anderson.
All right, Mr. Chair, if there's no further discussion, I'll renew my motion.
Senator Vickerman, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I promised two members of the committee earlier, Senator Scoy and Senator Dill, that we would pass out of the committee. We'd take a look at a couple provisions. If I understand it right, this will come back to my budget division or our budget division, and we could do it there. Is that can somebody tell me?
I understand it has several stops left, but next stop is energy policy.
That's fine. I just promised them I pull it to my committee. They don't want to do that. If we can work it out in the budget part, that'd be a lot easier. Well, can that be done?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, after it goes to the, and Senator Rickman, after it goes to the energy policy, I'm assuming that that's the last stop with the rules provisions taken out before going to the Finance Committee. So it would be go to the Finance Committee. Then it's a question of, it'll be referred to probably to Senator Anderson's division. And there are pieces that are in your division, pieces that are in Senator Anderson's division. What's possible to do is to, rather than actually hearing the bill again, is when you, these provisions will have to be part of an omnibus funding bill. Yeah. And so it could also be heard as part of that omnibus funding bill rather than having the actual bill in hand. But the provisions will be in front of that committee again.
I've heard it twice. I don't know if I'll hear it three times. I just give my word that we
that answer
have a shot at that part.
You satisfied with that, Senator Bickerman?
Well, that's okay with me.
Senator Shadi, you? Okay.
I was maybe going to mention, Mr. Chair and members, if the gavel sounds a little louder today, you could hold that up.
It's not necessarily my enthusiasm. It's
because staff tracked down a new little gavel pounder for me.
Did that come from?
And it's an 8-year-old hybrid poplar developed by the NRRI.
Nice.
So in the spirit of biofuels, that's what we're using today.
We're going to have a campfire up with that.
That's right.
Senate File 480, as amended, is now before us. Any other discussion? Moving on to the Energy Policy Committee, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? It is louder.
Nice.
You got a few replacements?
Thank you, Ms. Chair and members.
And this committee stands adjourned.
I want to know if they killed that tree. They killed that tree.